Chapter 14, How Not to Die from Parkinson's Disease. Back in the 1960s, at the height of the Civil Rights Movement, my dad was dodging bullets during the Brooklyn riots and setting up shots at just the right angle to best capture images of my mother being arrested at protests and dragged away again and again. His most famous work, one of Esquire's 1963 Photos of the Year, depicted a family friend, Mineral Bramletter, suspended in a Christ-like pose between two white police officers as another cop clutched at his throat. What a cruel twist of fate that a celebrated photojournalist got a disease that caused his hands to shake. For years, my dad suffered at the hands of Parkinson's. Slowly and all too painfully, he lost the ability to take care of himself, to live his life in any semblance of the way he had before. He became bedridden and compromised in every way imaginable. After 16 years of fighting, he went to the hospital one last time. As so often happens with chronic disease, one complication led to another. He got pneumonia and spent his last few weeks on a ventilator, suffering through a painful, prolonged death. The weeks he spent in that hospital bed before he passed were the worst weeks of both his and my life. Hospitals are terrible places to be and terrible places to die. That's why each of us needs to take care of ourselves. As my father's story shows, Parkinson's can end badly. It's the second most common neurodegenerative disease after Alzheimer's. Parkinson's is a disabling disorder affecting the speed, quality, and ease of movement. Its hallmark symptoms, which worsen as the disease progresses, include hand tremors, limb stiffness, impaired balance, difficulty walking. It can also affect mood, thinking, sleep. Parkinson's is currently not curable. The disease is caused by the die-off of specialized nerve cells in a region of the brain that controls movement. It typically presents after age 50. A history of head trauma can increase risk, which may be why heavyweight boxers, including Muhammad Ali, and NFL players, including Hall of Famer Forrest Gregg, have fallen victim to the condition. However, most people may be more likely to develop the disease from toxic pollutants in our environment that can build up in the food supply and eventually affect the brain. The National Cancer Institute's 2008-2009 U.S. Presidential Cancer Panel report discussed the degree to which we're being inundated with industrial chemicals. It concluded, quote, "The American people, even before they're born, are bombarded continually with myriad combinations of these dangerous exposures. The panel urges you, Mr. President, most strongly to use the power of your office to remove the carcinogens and other toxins from our food, water, and air that needlessly increase healthcare costs, cripple our nation's productivity, and devastate American lives," unquote. In addition to increasing your risk of developing many cancers, industrial pollutants may also play a role in the onset of such brain-deteriorating, neurodegenerative diseases as Parkinson's. And those toxins are residing in most people's bodies. Every few years, the CDC measures the level of chemical pollutants in the bodies of thousands of Americans from across the country. According to the agency's findings, the bodies of most women in the United States are contaminated with heavy metals, along with a number of toxic solvents, endocrine-disrupting chemicals, fire retardants, chemicals from plastics, polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, and banned pesticides such as DDT, publicized by American biologist Rachel Carson in her 1962 bestseller, Silent Spring. In many cases, 99 to 100% of the hundreds of women tested were found to have detectable levels of these pollutants circulating in their bloodstreams. Pregnant women were found to harbor, on average, up to 50 different chemicals. Could the presence of these potential toxicants in their bodies mean that they're also being passed on to their children? Researchers decided to put that question to the test by measuring pollutant levels right after delivery in the baby's umbilical cord blood. As soon as the cord is cut, a little blood can be squirted into a vial. After studying more than 300 women who had recently given birth, researchers found that 95% of umbilical cord samples showed detectable DDT residues, and this is now decades after the pesticide was banned. What about men? Men tend to have even higher levels of certain pollutants than women. A clue to solving this mystery was found when breastfeeding history was taken into account. Women who never breastfed had about the same level of certain toxicants in their bodies as men, but the longer they breastfed their children, the lower their levels fell, suggesting that they were detoxing themselves by passing the pollutants down to their children. It appears that blood levels of some pollutants in women may drop by nearly half during pregnancy, in part because their bodies pass them off through the placenta. That may be why breast milk concentrations of pollutants appear higher after the first pregnancy than in subsequent ones. This could explain why birth order was found to be a significant predictor of pollutant levels in young people. Basically, firstborn kids may get first dibs on mom's store of toxic waste, leaving less for their baby brothers and sisters. Even mothers who were breastfed as infants themselves tend to have higher levels of pollutants in their own breast milk when they grow up, suggesting a multi-generational passing down of these chemicals. In other words, what you eat now may affect the levels of toxic chemicals in your grandchildren. When it comes to feeding babies, breast is still best, absolutely. But rather than detoxing into our children, we should strive not to tox ourselves in the first place. In 2012, researchers from the University of California, Davis, published an analysis of the diets of California kids aged 2 through 7. Children are thought to be especially vulnerable to chemicals in the diet because they're still growing and thus have a comparably greater intake of foods and fluids relative to their weight. Chemicals and heavy metals in children's bodies from the foods they ate were indeed found to exceed safety levels by a larger margin than in adults. Cancer risk ratios, for example, were exceeded by a factor of up to 100 or more. For every child studied, benchmark levels were surpassed for arsenic, the banned pesticide dieldrin, and potentially highly toxic industrial byproducts called dioxins. They were also too high for DDE, a byproduct of DDT. Which foods contributed the most heavy metals? The number one food source of arsenic was poultry among preschoolers, and for their parents, tuna. The top source for lead, dairy. For mercury, seafood. Those concerned about exposing their children to mercury-containing vaccines should know that eating just a single serving of fish each week during pregnancy can lead to more mercury in their infant's body than injecting them directly with about a dozen mercury-containing vaccines. You should strive to minimize mercury exposure, but the benefits of vaccination far exceed the risks. The same cannot be said for tuna. Where in the food supply are these pollutants found? Today, most DDT comes from meat, particularly fish. The oceans are essentially humanity's sewer. Everything eventually flows into the sea. The same is true when it comes to dietary exposure to PCBs, another set of banned chemicals once widely used as insulating fluid in electrical equipment. A study of more than 12,000 food and feed samples across 18 countries found that the highest PCB contamination was found in fish and fish oil, followed by eggs, dairy, and then other meats. The lowest contamination was found at the bottom of the food chain in plants. Hexachlorobenzene, another pesticide banned nearly half a century ago, today may be found mainly in dairy and meat, including fish. Perfluorochemicals, or PFCs, overwhelmingly found in fish and other meats. As for dioxins, in the United States, the most concentrated sources may be butter, followed by eggs, and then processed meat. The level in eggs may help explain why one study found that eating more than a half an egg a day was associated with about 2 to 3 times higher odds for cancers of the mouth, colon, bladder, prostate, and breast, compared to those who didn't eat any eggs at all. If women want to clean up their diets before conception, how long does it take for these pollutants to leave their systems? To find out, researchers asked people to eat one large serving a week of tuna or other high-mercury fish for 14 weeks to boost their levels of the heavy metal and then stop. By measuring how fast the subjects' mercury levels dropped, the scientists were able to calculate the half-life of mercury in the body. The subjects appear to be able to clear about half the mercury from their bodies within 2 months. This result suggests that within a year of stopping fish consumption, the body can detox nearly 99% of it. Unfortunately, other industrial pollutants in fish can take longer for our bodies to get rid of. The half-lives for certain dioxins, PCBs, and DDT byproducts found in fish are as long as 10 years. So to get that same 99% drop, it could take more than a century, a long time, to delay having your first child. By now, you're probably wondering how these chemicals get into your food in the first place. One reason is that we've so thoroughly polluted our planet that the chemicals just come down the rain. For example, scientists have reported 8 different pesticides contaminating the snow-packed peaks of Rocky Mountain National Park in Colorado. Once pollutants get into the soil, they can work their way up the food chain at increasing concentrations. Consider that before she's slaughtered for meat, a dairy cow may eat 75,000 pounds worth of plants. The chemicals in the plants can get stored in her fat and build up in her body. So when it comes to too many of the fat-soluble pesticides and pollutants, every time you eat a burger, you are, in effect, eating everything that burger ate. The best way to minimize your exposure to industrial toxins may be to eat as low as possible on the food chain, a plant-based diet. A side note on reducing dioxin intake. Dioxins are highly toxic pollutants that accumulate in the fat of animal tissue, such that about 95% of human exposure comes from eating animal products. Sometimes that's because of contaminated animal feed. In the 1990s, for example, a supermarket survey found that the highest concentration of dioxins was found in farm-raised catfish. Apparently, the catfish were provided feed mixed with an anti-caking agent laced with dioxins that may have originated from sewage sludge. That same feed was given to chickens, affecting approximately 5% of the U.S. poultry production at the time. That would mean that people ate hundreds of millions of contaminated chickens. Of course, if it was in the chickens, then it was also in their eggs. Indeed, elevated dioxin levels were found in U.S. eggs, too. The U.S. Department of Agriculture estimated that less than 1% of feed was contaminated, but 1% of egg production would mean more than 1 million tainted eggs per day. But the catfish contamination was even more widespread. More than 1/3 of all U.S. farm-raised catfish tested were found to be contaminated with dioxins. In 1997, the Food and Drug Administration called on feed manufacturers to stop using these dioxin-tainted ingredients, stating that, quote, continued exposure to elevated dioxin levels in animal feed increases the risk of adverse health effects on animals and to humans consuming animal-derived food products, unquote. So, did the feed industry clean up its act? Up to 500 million pounds of catfish continued to be churned out of U.S. fish farms every year, but it wasn't until more than a decade later that our government went back and checked for compliance. Researchers from the USDA tested samples of catfish from all over the country, and in 2013 reported that 96% of tested samples still contained dioxins or dioxin-like compounds. And when they checked the feed used to raise these fish, more than half the samples came back as contaminated. In other words, the feed industry has known for more than 2 decades that what they were feeding to animals, and ultimately to most of us, may contain dioxins. But apparently, they continue this practice unabated. The Institute of Medicine has made suggestions for reducing dioxin exposure, such as trimming fat from meat, including poultry and fish, and avoiding the recycling of animal fat into gravy. Wouldn't it be more prudent just to trim the amount of animal foods from your diet instead? Researchers have estimated that a plant-based diet could wipe out about 98% of your dioxin intake. Smoking and Parkinson's disease. The CDC recently celebrated the 50-year anniversary of their landmark 1964 Surgeon General Report on Smoking, considered one of the great public health achievements of our time. It's interesting to go back and read the reactions of the tobacco industry to such reports. For example, an industry insider argued that contrary to the Surgeon General's argument that smoking costs our nation billions, quote, smoking saves the country money by increasing the number of people dying soon after retirement, unquote. In other words, just think how much we're saving on Medicare and Social Security thanks to cigarettes. The tobacco industry also criticized the Surgeon General's, quote, lack of balance regarding the benefits of smoking, unquote. As they testified before Congress, these positive health benefits included the feelings of well-being, satisfaction, and happiness, and everything else. Beyond all the happiness the Surgeon General was trying to extinguish, the Tobacco Institute argued everything else included protection against Parkinson's disease. As it happens, quite unexpectedly, more than 5 dozen studies over the past half century have collectively shown that smoking tobacco is indeed associated with significantly lower incidence of Parkinson's disease. Valiant attempts have failed to explain away these findings. Maybe, public health scientists countered, it's because smokers are dying off before they get Parkinson's? No, smoking appears protective at all ages. Maybe it's because smokers drink more coffee, which we know to be protective? No, the protective effect remained even after researchers controlled studies for coffee intake. Identical twin studies helped rule out genetic factors in the link. Even simply growing up in a home where your parents smoked appears protective when it comes to developing Parkinson's. So was the tobacco industry right? Does it even matter? Since the Surgeon General's groundbreaking 1964 report, more than 20 million Americans have died as a result of smoking. Even if you didn't care about dying from lung cancer or emphysema, even if you just cared about protecting your brain, you still shouldn't smoke, because smoking is a significant risk factor for stroke. But what if you could get the benefits of smoking without the risks? Maybe you can. The neuroprotective agent in tobacco appears to be nicotine. Tobacco is part of the nightshade family, the group of plants that includes tomatoes, potatoes, eggplants, and peppers. It turns out they all contain nicotine, too, but in such trace amounts, hundreds of times less than what's found in a single cigarette, that the protective potential of vegetables was dismissed as inconsequential. But then it was discovered that just one or two puffs of a cigarette can saturate half your brain's nicotine receptors. Then we learned that even exposure to secondhand smoke may lower the risk of Parkinson's, and that the amount of nicotine exposure sitting in a smoky restaurant is on the same order as what you might get from eating a healthy meal in a smoke-free restaurant. So might eating lots of nightshade vegetables protect you from Parkinson's after all? Researchers at the University of Washington decided to find out. When they tested for nicotine, they found none in eggplants, just a little in potatoes, some in tomatoes, and more significant amounts in bell peppers. These results were consistent with what researchers found when they studied nearly 500 newly diagnosed Parkinson's patients compared to controls. Eating nicotine-rich vegetables, especially peppers, was associated with significantly lower risk of Parkinson's disease. This effect was only found in non-smokers, which makes sense because the flood of nicotine from cigarettes would likely overwhelm any dietary effect. This study may help explain previous protective associations in terms of Parkinson's risk that have been tenuously found for tomato and potato consumption, as well as for the nightshade-rich Mediterranean diet. The University of Washington researchers concluded that more research is needed before individuals should consider dietary interventions to prevent Parkinson's disease, but when that intervention is simply enjoying more healthy dishes like stuffed peppers with tomato sauce, I don't see any reason why you should have to wait. Dairy. Parkinson's patients have been found to have elevated levels of an organochlorine pesticide in their bloodstreams, the class of largely banned pesticides that includes DDT. Autopsy studies have also found elevated levels of pesticides in the brain tissue of those with Parkinson's. Elevated levels of other pollutants like PCBs have also been found in their brains, and the higher certain PCB concentrations, the higher the degree of damage found specifically in the brain region thought responsible for the disease, called the substantia nigra. As noted earlier, though many of these chemicals were banned decades ago, they persist in the environment. You can continue to be exposed to them through the consumption of contaminated animal products in your diet, including dairy. Indeed, people who eat dairy-free, plant-based diets were found to have significantly lower blood levels of the PCBs implicated in the development of Parkinson's disease. A meta-analysis of studies involving more than 300,000 participants found that overall dairy consumption was associated with significantly increased risk of Parkinson's disease. They estimated that Parkinson's risk may increase 17% for every daily cup of milk consumed. Quote, contamination of milk with neurotoxins may be of critical importance, unquote, researchers offered by way of explanation. For example, neurotoxic chemicals like tetrahydroisoquinoline, a compound used to induce Parkinsonism in primates in laboratory studies, appears to be found predominantly in cheese. The concentrations found were low, but the concern is that they may accumulate over a lifetime of consumption, resulting in the elevated levels found in the brains of Parkinson's patients. There have been calls on the dairy industry to require screenings of milk for such toxins, but they have so far gone unanswered. A recent Nutrition Journal editorial considered the case closed. Quote, "The only possible explanation for this effect is the evidence of the contamination of milk by neurotoxins," unquote. But there are alternate explanations for the clear-cut link between dairy and Parkinson's. For example, pollutant levels wouldn't explain why Parkinson's appears more closely tied to the consumption of the milk sugar lactose than to milk fat, more closely tied to milk than to butter. So maybe the culprit is galactose, the sugar in milk that I described before, blamed for an increased risk of bone fractures, cancer, and death. Those with an inability to detoxify the lactose in milk not only suffer damage to their bones, but also to their brains. This may help explain the link between milk intake and Parkinson's, as well as the link between milk and another neurodegenerative disease called Huntington's disease. Indeed, higher consumption of dairy products appeared to double the risk of early-onset Huntington's. Another explanation is that milk consumption lowers blood levels of uric acid, an important brain antioxidant shown to protect nerve cells against the oxidative stress caused by pesticides. Uric acid may slow the progression of Huntington's and Parkinson's, and, most importantly, may lower the risk of getting Parkinson's in the first place. Too much uric acid, however, can crystallize in your joints and cause a painful disease called gout. So uric acid can be thought of as a double-edged sword. Too much uric acid is also associated with heart disease and kidney disease, too little with Alzheimer's, Huntington's, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, and stroke. Those on dairy-free plant-based diets appear to hit the sweet spot in terms of most optimal uric acid levels for longevity. Milk may not do a body good, at least when it comes to your bones and your brain. A side note on plant-based diets and pollutants. As we've discussed, organochlorines are a group of chemicals that includes dioxins, PCBs, and such insecticides as DDT. Although most were banned decades ago, they persist in the environment and creep up the food chain into the fat of animals people eat. What if you don't eat any animal products at all? Researchers have found that vegans were, quote, significantly less polluted than omnivores, unquote, when measuring levels of organochlorines in their blood, including a variety of PCBs, and one of Monsanto's long-banned aerochloric compounds. This finding is consistent with studies showing higher levels of organochlorine pesticides in the body fat and breast milk of those who eat meat. People eating completely plant-based diets have also been found to have markedly lower levels of dioxins in their bodies, as well as decreased concentrations with PBDEs, the flame-retardant chemical pollutants also linked to neurological problems. No surprise, the highest levels of flame retardants in the U.S. food supply have been found in fish, though the primary source of intake for most Americans is poultry, followed by processed meat. This discovery helps to explain the significantly lower levels of PBDEs in the bodies of those eating meat-free diets. It appears that the more plant-based foods you eat and the longer you go without eating animal products, the lower your levels fall. No regulatory limits have been set for PBDEs in food, but as U.S. Department of Agriculture researchers noted in a survey of flame-retardant chemicals in domestic meat and poultry, quote, "reducing the levels of unnecessary, persistent toxic compounds in food and your diet is certainly desirable," unquote. Eating healthier can also reduce the concentrations of heavy metals in your body. The levels of mercury in the hair of those eating plant-based diets were found to be up to 10 times lower than those who ate fish. Within 3 months of switching to a plant-based diet, the levels of mercury, lead, and cadmium growing out in your hair appeared to significantly drop, but build back up when meat and eggs were added back into the diet. Unlike heavy metals, though, some organochlorine pollutants can stick around for decades. Any DDT in your KFC may stay with you for the rest of your life. Berries. Dr. James Parkinson, in his original centuries-old description of the disease that bears his name, described a characteristic feature, torpid bowels, or constipation, that may precede the diagnosis by many years. We've since learned that bowel movement frequency may even be predictive of Parkinson's. Men with less than daily bowel movements, for instance, were found to be 4 times more likely to develop the disease years later. Reverse causation has been suggested. Maybe constipation didn't lead to Parkinson's. Maybe Parkinson's, even decades before it was diagnosed, led to constipation. This idea was supported by anecdotal evidence suggesting that throughout their lives, many who go on to develop Parkinson's reported never feeling very thirsty, and perhaps decreased water intake contributed to their constipation. Alternately, given the link between dietary pollutants and Parkinson's, constipation may be contributing directly to the disease. The longer feces stay in the bowel, the more neurotoxic chemicals in the diet may be absorbed. There are now more than 100 studies linking pesticides to an increased risk for Parkinson's disease, but many of them are based on subjects' occupational or ambient exposure. Approximately 1 billion pounds of pesticides are applied annually in the United States, and simply living or working in high-spray areas may increase your risk. The use of common household pesticides like bug sprays is also associated with significantly increased risk. How exactly do pesticides increase your risk for Parkinson's? Scientists think they may cause DNA mutations that increase your susceptibility or affect the way certain proteins fold in your brain. In order for proteins to function effectively, they have to be in the right shape. As you make new proteins in your cells, if they come out folded incorrectly, they're simply recycled and your body tries again. Certain misfolded proteins, however, can take a shape that your body has difficulty breaking down. Should this glitch happen continuously, the malformed proteins can accumulate and result in the death of the brain's nerve cells. Misfolded beta-amyloid proteins, for example, are implicated in Alzheimer's disease. Misfolded prion proteins cause mad cow disease. A different malformed protein causes Huntington's, and misfolded alpha-synuclein proteins can lead to Parkinson's disease. In the most comprehensive study of this sort to date, 8 out of 12 common pesticides tested were able to trigger the accumulation of alpha-synuclein proteins in human nerve cells in a petri dish. As I've said, Parkinson's disease is caused by the die-off of certain specialized nerve cells in a region of the brain that controls movement. By the time first symptoms arise, 70% of these critical cells may already be dead. Pesticides are so good at killing these neurons that scientists often use pesticides in the lab to try to recreate Parkinson's in animals to test new treatments. If pesticides are killing off your brain cells, is there anything you can do to stop the process other than lowering your exposure to them? There are no known drugs that can prevent these misfolded proteins from accumulating, but certain phytonutrients called flavonoids, which are found in fruits and vegetables, may have protective effects. Researchers tested 48 different plant compounds able to cross the blood-brain barrier to see if they were able to stop alpha-synuclein proteins from clumping together. To their surprise, not only did a variety of flavonoids inhibit these proteins from accumulating, but they could also break down existing deposits. This study suggests that by eating healthfully, you can reduce your exposure to pollutants while countering their effects at the same time. And when it comes to countering the effects of pesticides, berries may be particularly useful. In a head-to-head battle between pesticides and berries, researchers found that pre-incubating nerve cells with a blueberry extract allowed them to better withstand the debilitating effects of a common pesticide. But most such studies were performed on cells in a petri dish. Is there any evidence in people that eating berries can make a difference? A small study published decades ago suggested that the consumption of blueberries and strawberries might protect against Parkinson's, but the question remained largely unanswered until a Harvard University study of about 130,000 people found that people who eat more berries do indeed appear to have significantly lower risk of developing the disease. The editorial that accompanied the study in the journal Neurology concluded that more research is necessary, but until then, an apple a day might be a good idea. Apples did appear to protect against Parkinson's, but only for men. Everyone, however, appeared to benefit from the consumption of blueberries and strawberries, the only berries included in the study. If you do decide to follow my recommendation to eat berries every day, I would advise not serving them with cream. Not only has dairy been shown to block some of the beneficial effects of berries, but, as we heard earlier, dairy products may contain compounds that cause the very damage the berries may be trying to undo. Cannibalistic feed biomagnification. If people just eat from the bottom two levels of the food chain, only plants and plant eaters, that is, cows, pigs, and chickens, fed grain and soybeans, why is the American populace so contaminated? Those of you who remember the mad cow disease story may know the answer. In modern agribusiness, there are essentially no more herbivores. Millions of tons of slaughterhouse byproducts continue to be fed to farm animals in the United States every year. Not only have we turned these animals into meat eaters, but virtual cannibals as well. When we feed farm animals millions of tons of meat and bone meal, we're also feeding them any pollutants this feed may contain. Then, after those animals are slaughtered, their trimmings go to feed the next generation of farm animals, potentially concentrating the pollutant levels higher and higher. So we end up like polar bears or eagles at the top of the food chain and suffer the biomagnified pollutant consequences. When we eat these farmed animals, it's almost as if we're eating every animal they ate. The use of slaughterhouse byproducts in animal feed can recycle both toxic heavy metals and industrial chemicals back into the food supply. Lead accumulates in animal bones and mercury in animal protein, which is why egg whites contain up to 20 times more mercury than do the yolks. Persistent lipophilic organic pollutants, known as PLOPs, P-L-O-P, really, build up in animal fat. Reducing meat consumption can help reduce exposure, but these pollutants can come back to us in a variety of animal products. Quote, although a vegetarian lifestyle can lower the body burden of PLOP, methylmercury, and lead, one toxicologist noted, quote, such benefits can be undermined by the consumption of contaminated milk and egg products. Farm animals that have been fed contaminated animal products produce contaminated milk and egg products, unquote. If you want to drop your PLOP, eat as low as possible on the food chain. A side note on coffee for preventing and treating Parkinson's disease. Could your cup of morning joe help prevent and perhaps even help treat one of our most crippling neurodegenerative conditions? It appears so. There have been at least 19 studies performed on the role coffee may play in Parkinson's, and overall, coffee consumption is associated with about one-third lower risk. The key ingredient appears to be the caffeine, since tea also appears protective, and decaf coffee does not. Like the berry phytonutrients, caffeine has been shown to protect human nerve cells in a petri dish from being killed off by pesticide and other neurotoxins. What about coffee for treating Parkinson's? In a randomized, controlled trial, giving Parkinson's patients the caffeine equivalent of 2 cups of coffee a day, or approximately 4 cups of black tea or 8 cups of green tea, significantly improved movement symptoms within 3 weeks. Of course, there's only so much you can charge for a cup of coffee, so drug companies have been trying to tweak caffeine into new experimental drugs, such as pilatinant and estradefalin. But it turns out that they don't appear to work any better than plain coffee, which is far cheaper and has a better safety record. There are a number of simple things you can do that may decrease your risk of dying from Parkinson's disease. You can wear seatbelts and bicycle helmets to avoid getting hit in the head. You can exercise regularly, avoid becoming overweight, consume peppers, berries, and green tea, and minimize your exposure to pesticides, heavy metals, and dairy and other animal products. It's worth it, trust me, when I say that no family should have to endure the tragedy of Parkinson's.